Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Annabelle again. We have an open hour today, just focused on Dwight Eisenhower's farewell speech, which he gave exactly 50 years ago today, in which he warned us about the military-industrial complex. And we're also going to honor the life and legacy of Martin Luther King, and we invite you to call in and talk about your thoughts about how Martin Luther King Jr.'s life has affected yours, because I think most Americans can say that his words and his teachings have had personal impact on our lives. And joining me today is Michael Swanson. He's a professor at Roger Williams University in Rhode Island, and he actually teaches a course called History in the Modern World, The Idea of Democracy, which sounds perfect for today. Thank you for joining us, Michael.
Oh, that's fine. And if you wish, Mike is just perfect. Always, my mother used to use the longest version of my name possible, but the more mad she was at me. So Mike works very fine by me.
Okay, great. So, Mike, I would love for you to just introduce yourself, because I gave you a very quick introduction. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
All right. I was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, to the son and daughter of immigrants from Sweden. So I'm quite proud of immigrants, and I'm quite fond of immigration as a thing that makes this country better. I went to public school and to then a church school in Chicago, Illinois, called North Park College, and then from there to Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, where I picked up my Ph.D. in American Studies. I could never decide on what I wanted to specialize on, so I chose something that I didn't have to specialize on anything with. And from there, I came to Roger Williams University in 1972, so I'm in my 39th year.
Excellent. Well, thank you for joining us. So I know you follow us on Facebook. That's how I found you. But how long have you been following the Coffee Party? And are you involved at all with your local chapter there?
I haven't found a local chapter with which I'm involved. One thing which is very strange about me is I don't drive a car. I am the last pedestrian in the whole world, and the town of Bristol where I live is a fairly small place. But I do follow you on Facebook and also through the internet generally, and also a number of other organizations as well.
Okay. Well,
I'm not quite so isolated as it might seem to be wheelless.
Well, I'm really eager to talk to you about, I know you've been teaching this for a time. You said in one of the threads that you always have your students read this speech, and I'm going to play a little bit of it to kind of get us started in the conversation. So I hope you like this part.
Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportion. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense of such. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experiment. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizen can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
So those are pretty haunting words there. I'm just, you know, it's really struck by that. I came across this speech actually not that long ago, I think in the last few years, and have been, it's still so unnerving to hear him. I actually want to also quote Susan Eisenhower, his granddaughter, talk about this. She just wrote an op-ed piece that got published on Friday, in which she says, "I've always found it rather haunting to watch old footage of my grandfather, Dwight Eisenhower, giving his televised farewell address to the nation on January 17, 1961. The 50-year-old thumb all but crackles with age as the president makes his earnest, uncoached speech. I was 9 years old at the time, and it wasn't until years later that I understood the importance of his words or the lasting impact of his message." And then she goes on to say that, looking back, it is easy to see the parallels to our era, especially how the complex has expanded since September 11, 2001. In less than 10 years, our military and security expenditures have increased by 119%. Even after subtracting the costs of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the budget has grown by 68% since 2001. In 2010, the United States is projected to spend at least $700 billion on its defense and security, the most in real terms that we spent in any year since World War II. So, Mike, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I heard the speech live. Well, it wasn't live because they didn't have coast-to-coast television back in those days, but it was brought in on video film and then broadcast from place to place to place to place, so I heard it when it was given. And it was impressive then, as it is impressive now. And because of when I was living, I understood the thing we were talking about. My grandfather, during World War II, had worked for a company called Northern Pump. And, of course, it was converted to war material, as all the companies were back in those days. General Motors could make tanks as well as make buses, and then when the war was over, it could make buses instead of tanks, or maybe railroad cars or cars or something, anyhow. And so I was aware of the change back then. I think the thing that I try to get across with my students is that part that starts with the conjunction of a military establishment and a large arms industry is new, but then more importantly, the part about it having an influence in every single city, every single state. One of the things that my students find hard to understand because of the generalization, I think, and the fact that news shows are so short, is that defense spending may be authorized in Washington, but it's spent in places like Groton, Connecticut, where Electric Boat is, or Portsmouth, Rhode Island, where Raytheon has a plant. And so what Eisenhower is talking about is about the industrial infrastructure becoming sort of the lifeline for the American manufacturing worker. And the more that one makes things which don't have civilian counterparts, the more the livelihood of the workers in the factory, the more the livelihood of the town itself depends on that particular form of production. Electric Boat makes submarines. Now, I don't think I've seen too many commuter submarines or anything other than maybe a ride at Disneyland. So if you're not making a submarine for military purposes, what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just wondering, though. There's the industry part. But I just want to quote this and see how it fits in with what you just said. This is his speech from 1953 called "A Chance for Peace," and what he said then was, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It's spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this, a modern brick school in more than 30 cities." So, yeah, I guess, you know, I'm just, there's the industry part. And then there's the fact that it is taking money away from other things that we could be doing, right? So
I would not deny that at all. The point that I'm trying to make about that is, and it should also be considered about this, that most of the material actually made never goes to war. It goes to obsolescence. It goes for rehabbing. If we think about right now the building of the F-35, a plane for which there is no mission, but a plane for which there are factories judiciously spread through enough congressional districts and enough states so that the Senate will be very hard to pull the plug on that particular plane. So I think you're absolutely right, but It's a somewhat of a mistake to think that everything that's spent actually winds up being used. Most of it rusts. If we think about the fact that we have 20,000 warheads estimated now for nuclear missiles, and that we have fired two warheads in anger more than 50 years ago, that'll give you something of the kind of thing I'm talking about here. They sit. They have to be guarded. They are decaying. Nobody wants to have the decayed stuff in their backyard. We don't know quite what to do with it. But this is that kind of being enmeshed that that Eisenhower is talking about. That in some sense that we've let ourselves get in a situation where moving these things from peaceful or into peaceful uses, moving the money into peaceful uses, doesn't solve the problem of the salaries and the locales of real people. Now, if you could use a person who builds a modern heavy bomber, also knew how to build a school, then we'd have a much easier time of it. But what Eisenhower is noticing, I think, partly is that we don't have – these skills are not transferable as they were in the previous generation. That's the big difference. We have devised a defense system which creates skills which are untransferable to any other walk of life. And then we're stuck with people that have gone into those professions. And then what do they do if we don't build – the F-35, what do all those people that work for Boeing or McDonnell Douglas do? You know what I'm saying?
That's a good question. I'm curious. What do you think? I wrote this on Facebook for this show. What do you think Eisenhower would say to us today? Well, how would he see our country today?
Oh, I think he would be tempted to say, "I told you so." Probably he would do it in a nice way. The man was a man of incredible civility, and so I certainly think that would be the case. He would, I think, say in some ways things have gotten worse, especially in that part of the speech which nobody pays much attention to, the part when he talks about the universities and their domination by the government, because it's not just the universities, but corporations themselves, which now fund university research. And so one doesn't, as he says, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. We don't pursue what we're curious about. We pursue what we can get a grant for. And I think he would say, "I told you so" about that as well.
But I think Okay, so beyond saying I told you so, which she absolutely, I think, has every reason to say, but what would he advise us? How would he advise us to actually undo this? Because obviously we didn't exactly heed his warnings. So some would argue that, well, it's too late. This, you know, military-industrial complex is too massive. We can't undo this thing. And we just have to live with it. I think some people would actually say that. But, I mean, I don't think he, being the man he is, would say, let's give up on it. Because he would, I think the problem with that is it would actually get worse. So I'm wondering what he would advise us to do about this right now.
Well, he actually does give some advice. That's the nice thing about a farewell speech. You can give advice. Mm-hmm. And whether people pay any attention to it or not is another matter altogether. But if you towards the end of the speech, when he talks about we can't mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking also the loss of their political and spiritual heritage. And then immediately following that,
mm-hmm.
talks about the diplomatic role. And one line which I think is very coffee party-ish, if I could use a phrase like that, down the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing small, mm-hmm. must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate and be instead mm-hmm. a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. And then such a confederation must be one of equals.
Mm-hmm.
I think he would be appalled by the politicization of foreign affairs. I think he'd be appalled by the politicization of domestic affairs. Mm-hmm. In his age, of course, he was not opposed to using the word defense for things which for instance, the interstate highway system began in his administration, and that was billed as a defense project.
Mm-hmm.
Drive the interstate, you're driving on defense.
Mm.
And the whole idea was, of course, if that they were going to send the bombs, you could get out of the city real quick. And I was educated under something called the National Defense Education Act. You know, everybody got all scared after Sputnik. And so a person could go to school and get government loans for their education and actually get some of that money forgiven if you went and taught in schools. Now, that's what Eisenhower programs. I wish I could say that his, I think his intellectual descendants still believe that sort of stuff, just most of them are not in the same party he was.
You know, I want to quote the last thing he says in the farewell address, which is, it just resonates so much with the fact that today is also Martin Luther King Day. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings, that those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibilities, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, that the scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made to disappear from the earth, and that in the goodness of time, all people will come to live together in peace, guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love. I love the fact that he ends his speech with love. This general, our president, ends his speech with, you know, the idea of mutual respect and love. And I guess I wonder, you know,
this is going to go academic on. You could tell me to shut up if you want. The sequence in this is really interesting. Race first, all races second, and all nations only third. That list. Now that I think is deliberate on his part. And so what we're looking at here is something which reminds me a lot of something else I've become interested in recently, which is the Charter for Compassion. This paragraph could be extracted and put right in there without having to change it at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. No, that's right. I mean, it's compassion, but it's, I feel like there's a spirit of generosity and you know, bigness of heart, bigness of vision that dominated a period of American history that I feel like we're losing to, I think, a fear about scarcity, you know, and that we're in this fierce competition with everyone else, domestic and foreign, for the few things that, that are left for us to actually attain. And I think it feels very much like we're in that state of nature, like, you know, do or die kind of survival mode. And that bigness of spirit that I think Eisenhower really embodied and really articulates here is being lost. And to me, that's like, it's such a big part of the American identity. It's a part of our history, part of our American dream. And if we lose that generosity, that bigness of spirit, that vision, then we're getting lost completely in every area of policymaking and politics. So that worries me, losing this big vision.
I think you're right about that too. And one of the things that's I think hard for us to recognize until you've been a little older or spent some time browsing around the internet, how much our definitions of things have changed. In terms of what's necessary. I always ask my students at the beginning of the semester, one of the things I ask them is, how many of them have always had a room of their own? I teach at a private university, not the most expensive in the world. But probably I'd say 75 or 80% of the students have never had to share a room. Now, my brother and I never had a room of our own. This was very typical. I mean, obviously, you know, we weren't mixing genders back in those days, but if you had a brother or a sister, you shared. And the thing was, what you learn by that in terms of how to negotiate, in terms of how to respect the other person in the room and yet not become a floor mat for the other person. And, of course, your parents help you learn that. But if they provide you with everything that leaves you with nothing to compromise over, nothing to learn to get without, and nothing to substitute handmade things for, where do you learn all those things? And if you don't learn them on the little level, how in the world do you ever learn them when it comes to a sort of macro level? You know.
That's
I see the world
question.
Different from people that have come to expect a 3-acre lot as an American right, you know.
Absolutely. I want to go back to Susan Eisenhower because her interpretation, I think, is really it's very touching and moving. Let's see, you know, she says, until today, perhaps, we have taken American leadership dominance and prosperity for granted. In those intervening years, we rarely asked if our policies were sustainable over the long haul. Indeed, it has been. It has only been since the catastrophic financial meltdown in 2008 that we've begun to think about the generational responsibilities we have for our grandchildren's prosperity and welfare. Eisenhower's words from the beginning of his presidency to the end come back to us from the mists of another era. They remind us, sadly, that sometimes we must revisit our past to learn what we have always known. And I think she, that sort of general, I think it reinforces that idea that we have to think beyond ourselves and think bigger. In her case, it's about thinking past our own generation to our children and grandchildren's generation and the responsibility we have to them. And it seems like that is definitely part of how we have always, I think that's how we always thought we were, but I think we have moved away from that. Like our in the way that our attention span has shrunken, it feels like our perspective of time has also, like, you know, we think so in short term. And I guess I feel like it has a lot to do with how we conduct our elections. Like, things are spread out in two-year increments. And so we think in terms of 2 to 4 years as opposed to a whole generation. And I definitely think that's been a real detriment to good government. What do you think?
Well, I think yes and no in a kind of way. Let me see if I can put it this way. Susan Eisenhower was 9 when she heard the speech. I was 19, so I'm 10 years older than Susan. If I push myself back in history, I've got parents and grandparents that lived through the Depression and didn't live through the Depression as members of the Army, not worrying about their jobs. And so one of the things that I learned all the time was not because I lived through the Depression myself. I lived through it second and third hand. And what taught in terms of frugality, in terms of not wasting resources, and, of course, also during World War II, we were on rationing, so we used bacon grease to make cookies with, wonderful cookies, I should say. There are generations now that for whom this financial meltdown is the first one they've ever really experienced, the longest one they've ever experienced. And we had a little glitch in terms of the internet bubble collapsing around 2000. But other than that, the recessions have been fairly mild, people have been quite willing, you know, to be helpful to other people during them. It's one of the things that just strikes me about this one is how, as we get long-term unemployment because the way people make money is changing, how stingy you become in terms of being willing to extend unemployment benefits or provide education, new skills, whatever necessary to keep people being productive. And because in America we tend to value people on the basis of their being productive, what we essentially are saying is you don't work, you're not worth anything if you're not working. And that, I think, is Eisenhower would be appalled at.
That's a really good point. Wow. Really good point. I guess the thing that I feel like comes back to me is, one way of putting it, but I mean, let me know what you think of this. I feel like, you know, as Americans, we're losing confidence. I think that's why fear is setting in. We're submitting to the fear because we're losing our confidence. And, I guess I feel like it's a long road to kind of, you know, regain that sense of confidence in ourselves as citizens of this country, you know, as a nation, because I feel there have been so many events that help to undermine our confidence in our government, in our economy now, in ourselves, that, you know, goes back to, I think like, you know, the assassinations in the 60s, it goes back to Vietnam, it goes to Watergate, all these traumas that I think we never really healed from, that we never fully processed. That we just kind of moved on, but didn't really kind of integrate the lessons from these very catastrophic, traumatic events. And so I feel like it's resulted in a loss of confidence in ourselves. And, you know, I think one of the things that is happening, this what we're calling this level of incivility and kind of almost violence in our political discourse, it's connected to that lack of confidence, you know. So, I don't know. I guess I see Eisenhower, like, I've been watching all these videos of him. Like, there's one of him talking, like, right after JFK was assassinated, and he's trying to give some guidance to the suffering, hurt, afraid American people. And there was so much gravitas in how he came across that I felt like it just made you have more confidence that America will go on. We are strong, because he starts talking about how he believes in the strength and the common sense of the American people. And it's just so reassuring to hear that. And I think very few people talk like that anymore. Or if they do, it just gets lost in the noise out there.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with you about that. I think one of the things that's also different is that there has developed a culture which finds it useful to make us less confident.
Mm-hmm.
And to make us more fearful. So there's something to be gained from this by a certain group of people. And if you're having, the easiest way to thwart a terrorist is just refuse to be terrified. People can do that. One of the things I think that also is useful about history, and what's interesting about history, is the people that have been through stuff that is so much more appalling than anything that we've gone through in our lifetimes. If we think about the people who got bombed in London during World War II, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are people who lived through it, not only lived through it, they lived through it with a kind of pride in living through it, and this sort of stalwart upper chin English thing, the Churchill thing. I keep thinking, what would happen if we had the Blitz in the United States and all of New York City had been destroyed instead of, of 19 people and two planes crashing into a couple of buildings. I've often thought, in some sense, we brag in our song about the land of the free and the home of the brave, and I keep wanting to say in a sort of cynical way, the land of the free and the home of the, well, not all that brave. And you don't need to have a Glock pistol at your side in order to give you a sort of mechanical bravery. I think you're right that Eisenhower would find that kind of. Of course, he went through all that himself. Normandy and D-Day. There's a man, and in World War One, who saw what real communal suffering was like. And I don't think you could scare a man who's been through that in a position of leadership, and he would never use that kind of thing to scare other people. Joe McCarthy did, but Judge Welch was able to say, "Have you no shame, Mr. McCarthy?" I have a feeling that when he said that, probably Eisenhower was clapping away like that in the White House, but I don't know for sure. I'll ask him.
that's a really good point. I want to also point out that a few days after this speech, Eisenhower's speech, John F. Kennedy gave his famous inaugural address. So literally three days later, he gives the speech, and I want to play a little bit of that as well. It's like, this is a bit like time travel, but I think these are just brilliant things for us to think about today, 50 years later. So,
the same revolutionary beliefs for which our forebears fought are still at issue around the globe. The belief that the rights of man come not from the generosity of the state, but from the hand of God. We dare not forget today that we are the heirs of that first revolution. To those new states whom we welcome to the ranks of the free, we pledge our word that one form of colonial control shall not have passed away merely to be replaced by a far more iron tyranny. We shall not always expect to find them supporting our view, but we shall always hope to find them strongly supporting their own freedom. And to remember that in the past, those who foolishly sought power by riding the back of the tiger ended up inside. Only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Well, there you go. Very effective, moving.
Well, but also very, very, very different. And I would say a more political and less thought-out speech. My own thing. For example, it would be very hard to name a generation which has not, before 1960, had to go through what he talked about having to go through. And I'm not so sure that we should ask what we should do for our country as much as we should ask what we should do for each other, which is a difference, you know, sort of political. Eisenhower talks about the people doing things in communities and as communities, and Kennedy's is a little different in thrust and focus. A little too much was what we call hubris. A little too much pride there for me.
Mm-hmm.
That's just
interesting. No, I think that's interesting. I mean, I guess the thing that I always liked about the speech was that it's part of that notion of greatness is to think beyond ourselves. And I think it's so easy to have the boundaries of our universe end with kind of our narrow self-interest, you know, especially when we feel like life is so stressful and it's such a struggle right now for so many that it's very easy to get very completely absorbed in our own needs. And I think it's such an important reminder to think beyond ourselves. It's humbling. I think it really goes back to, I think, what Eisenhower said at the end of his speech about mutual respect and love. Like, why would he mention love if it didn't involve caring about people outside of ourselves? And that is political. That's not separate from politics.
No, but I'm saying that's where Eisenhower's speech is different.
Mm-hmm.
He does mention that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't.
Right. But I think John F. Kennedy in his own way tried.
Softer virtues in John Kennedy's speech. John Kennedy doesn't talk about the need for the nations to come together in confederation of equals. He doesn't say
true.
The weakest must come to the conference table with the same confidence as do we, protected as we are by our moral, economic, and military strength. The table scarred by many past frustrations cannot be abandoned for the certain agony of the battlefield. So there's a very different sort of a sense of cooperation, I think, with the world in Eisenhower's speech. Again, I have the advantage of having the Eisenhower speech in front of me. So I have to remember the Kennedy speech from the back of my brain someplace.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I mean, you know, it probably rings more sort of nationalistic, the JFK speech, as opposed to Eisenhower's speech that definitely gestures at a kind of unity with all human beings, a global identity. I think that, you know, I mean, I guess I feel like they're really gesturing at very similar things, because it is so easy for us to get self-absorbed, and it's just that, just to be able to expand our sense of our understanding of interest, that I think is to me of just great interest. I'm just wondering, you know, Eisenhower said that he fears for America when someone is sitting at his desk that doesn't understand the military and the role of the military-industrial complex. Do you think that that's the case right now? Do you think President Obama has an understanding of the military-industrial complex and is grappling with it?
I think, what's the best way to put it this way? I think that, I'm having a dozen different ways I want to put this. I want to make sure I say close to right. He is in, I think, a position that no other president before him has had to be in. In a way, it's kind of parallel to Kennedy. And to put it this way, Kennedy was the first Catholic president.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about the campaign back in those days, you don't hear very much about it now. But, of course, there was a great deal of anti-Catholic sentiment brought out, some very vicious sort of things said, things said about Joseph Kennedy, and things said about Kennedy being the servant of the Pope, et cetera. And I think, you know, had to, and he made a speech, to define himself in such a way that would make a Catholic president acceptable to a Protestant nation. And it's also worthwhile noticing that we haven't had another Catholic president since Kennedy.
Interesting.
Yeah, and of course, Obama's parallel is he's the first black president.
Mm-hmm.
Be damned if he does, he'll be damned if he doesn't. He will find whatever he does closed in very subtle racial respects, either because he's too uppity by being too firm, or too uncle-ish by being not firm enough. Nastiest things said about him are said about him by his allies, or putative allies anyway. It drives me nuts when they do. And given the other thing, of course, that Eisenhower says in his speech, which also I think was pretty much true, my official relationship with Congress ends in a feeling on my part of gratitude that we've been able to do so much together. Well, I don't think that Barack Obama could say that right now if he is leaving office. So we had a more bipartisan approach in the 50s and into the 60s that would let a person lead without having every opportunity for leadership come under criticism even before the oath was taken. So. The left balls him out for not being left enough, and the right balls him out for waking up in the morning. What can you say?
But, I mean, I know President Kennedy had the benefit of Eisenhower's counsel during the Cuban Missile Crisis and so on. I mean, I'm wondering what Eisenhower would say to President Obama today about the two wars, about the military-industrial complex. What do you think? If you could speak for Eisenhower.
Very interesting, you know, because Eisenhower inherited one war. In order, and he did get us out of it. But in some sense, it didn't. It wasn't over within 2 minutes of his inauguration either. I think that the military-industrial complex has part of it, but part of it also has to be with a well-oiled talk machine that is ready to call him a traitor or a loser if by any chance we don't find a way to define victory so we can get out of it. You know, it's a situation. What would have happened if we had not been involved in both those wars? Say that Obama had been elected president 8 years earlier, or say that Gore had been elected president. I suspect neither of the wars would have happened. But that's only, again, my supposition. There may have been a military punishment, but I don't think there would have been the whole bit about weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist in Iran and or in Iraq, rather. Nature.
Interesting. Wow. Well, I didn't. We only have a few minutes left, actually, and we didn't even really get to Martin Luther King. I had kind of planned on having people call in about Martin Luther King, but we can't finish the hour without talking about Martin Luther King. And I, since I have you on, I'm going to put you in the hot seat and ask you, how has Martin Luther King's teachings affected your life, you know, if at all? I'm assuming he has.
Oh, very, very, very much. Of course, I lived through the 60s and was involved. The Kent State catastrophe happened 20 miles from me when I was in graduate school at Western Reserve University, and there were times when the National Guard was camped in a field behind the apartment building which I was living in, and we had to abide by curfew. And so the 60s were very much a part of this, and the 60s were very much a part of Martin Luther King was very much a part of the 60s. While I was in Cleveland, we elected the first black mayor of Cleveland, and that's a trend which has really taken off. Lots of black mayors now in cities which aren't all black. And I would say that everything he had to say was very much well accepted by Northern college students of my generation, at that time Northern graduate school students. And of course, the assassination itself was an incredible thing to have happen. I also have the students read the letter from Birmingham Jail every semester. So I could have put that up on my Facebook page as well, but it was Eisenhower that we happened to hit the anniversary of this time around. The man, he's a prophet, probably the best way to put it. A man whose understanding of he wasn't just a black preacher. He was a person that knew the rhetoric of preaching, even when it was not a rhetoric of a religious topic. He knew how to do it. He knew how to do it in terms of when to pause, when not to pause, when to raise his voice, when to go fast, when to go slow. The I Have a Dream speech, of course, is a model of that kind of rhetoric. And this is one of the things I think also that Obama as an orator owes a lot to Martin Luther King. I think it was C-SPAN or somebody asked today on the Internet who embodies the spirit of Martin Luther King. And several people said Barack Obama, but I turned around and said Michelle Obama, because she does more public service work than about anybody I know, and there's no reason why a man's spirit couldn't be embodied by a woman.
Well, interesting. I didn't think of that. Well, I guess I'm curious about how you feel since you've been teaching for so long. I mean, do your students kind of take away the same lessons from both Dwight Eisenhower and Martin Luther King? I mean, do their words still resonate after all these years with your students?
It takes more time to resonate. This is not because the students aren't as smart as before, but language is changing. How they use language changes. You know, there were no air quotes in Eisenhower's day. So to get them to understand, what's also the case is always the case. there is a subtext and a context for a speech that's very much based on contemporary life. I understood most of everything Eisenhower said because I was living at the time he said it. I realized for the first time, actually, and of course you get marked by things. First time I realized that I had to be a little bit more contextual about things with students was once when I had mentioned the Kennedy assassination, and one of the students raised his hand and said, I wasn't even born then. And immediately I felt very old, and I realized that if I was going to talk about some of this stuff, I'd have to be a little more careful about the language, and especially about the method of using language. If you notice, the Eisenhower language is much more formal, in a sense, than even the Kennedy language. Sentences are longer, and for people that are used to texting and YouTubing and whatever else, you have to get them to slow down. I think that speed reading was one of the worst things that people ever tried to teach people. What you need to do is have a million different reading speeds and use the appropriate speed for what you're trying to read.
Yeah.
And I think, as I've said, it can be easily made to resonate. There's no problem at all with Martin Luther King resonating because he's, in a way, you know, he's never really died. They've heard his name not just because of the holiday, every year of their life, something has come up that brings up the name of Martin Luther King. Plus, in high school history, much more likely to cover King than cover Eisenhower. In high school history now, well, we can talk about doing this for a long time. When I went to high school, there was 52 years less history to know than there is now. And my students say I had it lucky because I didn't have to know so much because there wasn't so much. And then I tell them that I was born during FDR's reign, not during Teddy Roosevelt's reign, so don't think I know everybody. I never met Lincoln. in a document.
Hey, Mike, thanks for joining us today. It ended up being a full hour. Thank you. And thanks for taking your time, and I would love to bring you back. This is a really fun conversation. You sound like a real person.
Well, I try. My cats think so.
And not corrupted by money.
No. I hope I can keep doing my work for a few more years. I love doing it.
Okay.
And if you ever want to have another chat, let me know.
I will. I'm going to end the show with Martin Luther King talking about the war. So thanks, everyone, for joining. And here's Martin Luther King.
War is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
Don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you're too arrogant. You don't change your way. I will rise up and break the backbone of your power, and I'll place it in the hands of a nation that doesn't even know my name. Be still and know that I'm God. The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burden both at the front and at home. Though the civil rights leaders, for various reasons, refuse or can't take a stand or have to go along with the administration, that's their business. But I'm afraid that I know that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
It's a war. I think.
Well, that's smart of the king. So thank you, everyone, for joining, and I will be back in a few days. We have a big weekend coming up in Washington, D.C., and hopefully you guys will be joining all of the country to take a decisive stand on Citizens United and the need for us to rein in corporate influence over our government, including the defense industry, including the banks. It's not that we're against people making money. That's not it at all. It's not about being against the wealthy. It's about the corrupting influence, the role of corruption that corporations have, people with wealth have on our elections and our policymaking today. And, yes, we have to make these institutional legislative fixes, absolutely, to rein in, corporate influence over our government. But it's also about American people standing up as citizens, dignifying ourselves as citizens because this is our government, and empowering ourselves, choosing to empower ourselves and our communities so that we can really participate in the democratic process. It's absolutely critical, and this is one of the things that President Eisenhower mentions in his speech, is we have to be an engaged, educated citizenry. And I think it is definitely our responsibility to practice and reinforce the democratic process. If we're not engaged, our democracy is anemic and it gets manipulated by people who have a vested interest. And so the only way to inoculate ourselves from that kind of manipulation, self-interested, profit-driven manipulation, is for us to fill that space, with our participation, instead of just being on the sidelines. So we're calling on American people to engage responsibly, with civility, with respect, and with love for our democratic process and our country, and our humanity. And unless we do that, there's no point in having these legislative fixes because people are going to find ways to game it and find loopholes in it. So we can't just do one without doing the other. We have to do both. So this is the weekend. The anniversary of Citizens United ruling is this Friday, January 21st. The first anniversary of the ruling, and we're going to have to take a stand. We're going to be in D.C. starting Thursday with Lobby Day. We're going to have a rally on Friday morning at 11 a.m. in front of the Capitol facing the Supreme Court. We're going to have 2 days of strategy meetings where we're going to bring together organizers and volunteers and brilliant experts and thinkers and strategists. We're going to get into a room at the Washington Plaza and really figure out how we're going to go forward to restore the democratic process in our country, so that we have a government that is of and by and for the people. And there's absolutely no turning back on this. We've got to go forward with this. So thank you for joining. I hope you join us this coming weekend in D.C. or wherever you are. Go to movementforthepeople.org for more information. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Look for a very tall guy with a beard. Maybe I'll be in Washington. I'm hoping if the weather cooperates, I will.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. See you
Bye-bye.
Soon. Bye.